listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. We are the messenger of good news. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and in a few minutes, we're going to have our daily lectionary study, looking at the New Testament, rightly distinguishing law and gospel for you. This morning, Pastor Scott Kearns of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Kansas, is going to join us to look at John chapter 9, verses 1 to 23. Going to read that text for you right now. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not this man who sinned or his parents, but the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been formerly blind. Now it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask of him." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God for it. Again, going to be looking at this more closely with Pastor Scott Kearns of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Kansas, on the other side of this 8 o'clock hour break. Beginning of the story, there's more to come on this matter. And what a fascinating thing, right? Here you have, I mean, it's the whole point of John. I mean, it was here you have the Son of God here to save. And the very people, his own, who ought to have received him, those who shared his bloodline and the ancient promises, they are the very people who cannot see him for who he is more than that. So enraged do they become by the free gift of eternal life that he is bringing that they begin to plot to kill him rather than to let him keep teaching it. Isn't it funny that that then becomes the gospel? More of that on the other side of this break. His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk. I know you want to stick around. See you in a minute. His Time on Worldwide KFUO. We're the messenger of good news here. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, ready to look at John chapter 9, verses 1 through 23. with Pastor Scott Kearns of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Kansas. If you've got a question or comment about the text for myself or Pastor Kearns, you'll need to tweet today. No one monitoring the phones. We'll be back with that tomorrow. You can tweet me at Rev Fisk, and we will definitely take your question or comment on the air, try to answer as best we can, rightly distinguish law and gospel for you, and leave you with that good news of who Jesus is and what he's done, ultimately, at the cross. Pastor Kearns, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you on. Can you tell the people a little bit about what it's like serving the saints out there in Lincoln, Kansas?
What an honor it is to serve the saints at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. And, well, I guess we're near Lincoln, Kansas. We actually don't, we're not even in a town. There's no town.
So huh.
We're out in the country, and it is wonderful, and it's been a great 4 years, I think, I've been out here now, so just wonderful.
Excellent. So is Lincoln, I don't know much about Lincoln, Kansas, I know Lincoln, Nebraska. How big is Lincoln?
It is definitely smaller than, as you say, Lincoln, Nebraska. Lincoln, Kansas has about 1,100 people.
Okay. And then you guys, the congregation's out in a field nearby.
About 15, 20 miles. Yeah.
Sounds like North Dakota. I've been there, done that. And great people, though, right? It's really amazing. You got a little church and people just show up. And they've been there a long time. Their family roots go deep. And God willing, they also confess what we believe.
That's absolutely right. Wonderful deal.
So we're going to be moving into John chapter 9. We've skipped much of chapter 8 thanks to the weekend. So, you know, before Abraham was, I am, and then maybe the lesser quoted, you are of your father, the devil. anything you'd like to say about that context or anything else about the book of John before we lead into 9, something we should know to make sure this section makes sense?
Yeah, well, you know, we were kind of this whole section, you know, going back from 7, 8, and now kind of getting into 9, remember we're in the temple, and so they make a point to that we're looking at John says that we're in the temple, we have this whole kind of thing that goes on with the Pharisees, and right, and we leave off in 8, you know, that they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus, you know, hid himself and went out of the temple, and so we're kind of we're going from there. Then we can go on to John chapter 9, and it'll make sense because they also kind of lead us and want to make sure that we know that we've got out of the temple and that now we're going along. So
right, so all of that about the Feast of Booths and that argument continues to escalate and escalate. And isn't it interesting that he calls the Pharisees sons of the devil, and that's not enough to make them kill him. It's when he then says, before Abraham was, I am. Now that's enough, right? And it really shows you he is claiming to be God. There are those who will say something like, oh, Jesus never claimed to be God. Well, he didn't say, I am God, the words. But when he says, before Abraham was, I am, the reason they're going to kill him is because he's claiming to be God. And then, of course, like you say, he leaves the temple. You just kind of wonder, well, how did that happen? But as he goes out, it seems that as he passed by is where 9 verse 1 picks up. And so the story is continuing. We're not jumping a bunch of days ahead, but it's right out of the temple after this this massive event and confrontation. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, there's a here starting at 9, just a note on there, and it's when it says as he passed by or at, sometimes they put an and there, but truly we're not talking, you know, it's not like the sentence goes on and we're not like a conjunction here, that this is kind of not necessarily, as you said, the story goes on, but we want to make sure this might have a little bit of time period, you know, whether a couple hours or something like that before,
right.
You know, it just didn't go right after it. So
9 verse 1 and a little bit after that, he says, and he, again, Jesus, then passed, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not this man who sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. So first, I mean, we don't want to go too fast past this idea that this guy is blind from birth. This isn't even just, you know, some sort of degenerative disease taking place. He came out of the womb like this. It's his entire life long. And then his disciples really give you a bit of an insight into Second Temple Judaism, the time, the theology of the day, which is that if you have something like that happen to you, it must be the direct result of some sort of evil in your life. Now, they ask then, well, what is it? Is it his evil or is it his parents' evil? And then Jesus has a stunning answer. This has nothing to do with anybody's individual sin. Now, I think we would understand that doesn't mean it's not part of the fall, the original sin of all of us, but it has nothing to do with any individual sin. And what he really is saying is, this guy was born blind, so I can find him right now and make him see that the works of God might be displayed in him. Any of that. Run with any of that.
Well, I mean, oh, goodness. You say it has to do with Second Temple Judaism, and I agree with you, but I think that there might be even more to that. Because when I hear that, and I hear, is it the man who sinned or his parents? I think, isn't that such a question that we ask today?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Karma, what is going on? I cannot believe that this happened to you, kind of thing. You must have done something terribly wrong for this to happen to you. How does that, it's so funny that actually, that idea has come back and been something that we, now as a people really do kind of feel, or at least see in our sinful minds, that idea that somebody could be sinful based, not just sinful in the sense that we are all under sin, but that specifically a sin is tied to a whatever this happened, and we can point to one specific sin being the cause of this infirmity. Sure, there are plenty of infirmities, but man, it's so prevalent in our day, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. When you say it's deeper, I mean, I would say this is our most natural religion, the religion of the law, which teaches that if you do good, you'll get good things, and if you do bad, you'll get bad things. And so therefore, if something bad happened, it must be because you haven't kept the law. Now, not everyone applies that to the Ten Commandments being the law, but they have their own little versions of whatever law, whether it's these days in kind of progressive society, it's eating all the right things, it's taking care of the environment, it's whatever you want to put in there. And Christians, in our piety, we make up laws just as much. And our tendency, our natural religion then, is to see something bad happen, whether it's to someone else or to ourselves, and think, oh, this must have something to do with what I've done. I mean, I think it's pretty common for a Christian to have something bad happen and think, this is a result of what I did. And Jesus is kind of saying, well, not necessarily. I mean, you can, obviously, if you smoke cigarettes your entire life and you get have a heart attack at age 65, it might have something to do with it, right? But that's not about sin. That's just about, practice, I guess, wisdom. But anyway, I've gone on a bit there, but I totally agree that this is who we are as a natural religious people born of Adam.
Yeah, that's so true. So, yeah, I think we kind of going on from this kind of can see how this kind of plays in. I think Jesus here makes a point that like you said, there is a distinct break. I'm not going to answer the question. I certainly could. I could talk about where sin comes from and what is the result of sin. I mean, I'm sure that Jesus could literally, enlighten all of us as to sin and the results of sin and stuff, but he doesn't go anywhere on that, does he?
No, the works of God might be displayed, right? It's here so I can do something about it. And now, verse 4, then, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And Chris asked a question about this on Twitter. He says, we presumably refers to the disciples. What work must they be doing? And what does while it is day refer to? Yes, does this mean the time before the cross? So first, let's take those as two different questions. When Jesus says, we must work the works of him who sent me, who's the we? Did I lose you?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, so as we think about that, I would say absolutely it's, I think Jesus here is talking, in the sense of he is the is the Trinity. You know, we have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and so, you know, he is talking in the divine we sense here, because certainly God is one who works, and that's thing. But you know, is it the disciples as well? You know, I can see some of that too. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. You know, so here he's referring to himself again. And then, yeah, I think it is certainly to the disciples and to all of us.
We have that divine mystery that Paul will talk about quite a bit, that to be the church is to be the body of Jesus, right? So there's this overlap, and Paul will actually apply at one point a prophecy of the Old Testament about the Holy Spirit to himself. and I don't think he's saying, you know, me, Paul. He's talking about this prophetic spirit still at work in the church today. You do have that, you know, earlier in the book, Jesus has talked in this plural about having the two witnesses, right? And that the Father is his witness as well. So it certainly starts with him, the Father, the Spirit, in him are working the works he's been sent to do. But then the overlap is into the church. I think that's a fair question, though. I mean, I would love to see some work on this because it's challenging. The one place I would disagree with Chris is that presumably this refers to the disciples. I don't think we can presume that. I think it's a big enough question, and maybe an easier question then is, so what is this while it is still day stuff about?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, every time I read this, I guess I am just that big a fan of Game of Thrones, where I think, oh, you know, the night is coming when there's terrors. But, well, you know, when we think of, you know, the end of the world, you know, we think of, you know, getting to that point where we're looking and seeing who is that light of the world. You know, that ultimately we, as we're looking forward to, you know, the end times, to judgment, to, you know, judgment day, as we're, you know, our eyes are fixed to that, you know, we are kind of waiting with, you know, anticipation. And we know that, you know, it's like the master who gave a feast and, you know, ultimately shut the door. So, I mean, there is a sense of there is going to be a final end, and we want to make sure that we are, you know, that we have, that we are seeing the works that God continues to perform in us each and every day.
Yeah. So in the rest of the Synoptic Gospel, certainly the night is a reference to this time now, and the day is always about the end of the world. And that I don't know that that's not here. It's a bit challenging though, because John is always working on a different level too. And so this, as long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world thing. It's almost like what Chris is kind of asking, you know, is this about the darkness that comes with the cross too, right? That I'm gonna do these healing things until you kill me, because I'm the light of the world. But then you're gonna have this cloak of darkness, and then I'm gonna do the real work of rising from the dead. But it's not like that's without the second coming and the end of the world and all that kind of stuff. So it's certainly a it's a passage that bears more study, and I'd love to hear someone like Dr. Weinrich put his two cents in on this. Before we go to break, let's see if we can pick up these last verses in the paragraph here. It's the miracle proper, right? So verse 6 and following, it says, having said these things, he, Jesus, spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. It's almost easy to overlook the miracle by the distraction of him using mud and spit. So you kind of got to it. You got this massive miracle. He actually heals this guy born blind. He can see. Wow. But then he doesn't just kind of say, see, which he at other places he does miracles just by talking, but he uses mud and then his saliva of all things. So any thoughts about that or ponderings on that?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it would be easy to just say, okay, well, there we go, we got ground, you know, we're the dust of the ground, and we got, you know, mud, and we got anointing, and, you know, hey, there's baptism, you know, oh my goodness, it's hard to see. But yeah, like you said, there's certainly points in that where we're like, okay, we need to take a step back. We need to kind of sit for a second and kind of see that there is, you know, there's certainly a whole host of ways he could heal this man. You know, he could have just spoken and it would have been, you know, what is this being teaching us or whatever? Because I think that here in this miracle, maybe more than others, I think that it's almost parable-esque. I don't know if I just invented a word, but
sure.
You know, the idea that this is certainly, I think, a miracle that is teaching us something, along with, you know, being a miracle in itself, because it would be very easy to gloss over it. And I think that there's maybe some point to that, because we need to see that there is a whole host of things going on here, and it's not just for, you know, healing this man, but in order that we might see who Jesus is and what he does by this. The restoral of the man's sight is vitally important to, you know, the idea of who we are, as we are certainly like the man spiritually blind.
So. Right. And certainly with what's going to follow up too, right? I mean, if there's a parable in the story, it's about who believes and why they believe. The one thing before we go to break that I would just throw in there is, in a book that's so concerned with water, you do have Jesus now healing with water from his body. And again, we're going to see this at the end of the book when the spear is shoved into his heart and water from his body is going to flow out onto the earth along with his blood. So you got this blood-water thing going back and forth. Makes me think of the great hymn, Water, Blood, and Spirit, crying, all pointing to, well, it is Christ. It's his work. It's his word. And it's not far away from baptism and the supper either, although, as you point out, not directly in the text, but certainly foreshadowed here. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. We'll be back after just a minute here to continue talking with Pastor Scott Kearns about John chapter 9. Stick around.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Concord Matters is a show seeking agreement in Christian confession. I'm Pastor Charles Henriksen, one of the hosts of Concord Matters, heard on Worldwide KFUO each Tuesday at 2 p.m. Central and a repeat on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Central. We take an in-depth look at the Book of Concord with some fine Lutheran theologians. Concord Matters, live on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. We are the messenger of good news. That good news is who Jesus is and what he has done for you. We're looking at what he did for us leading up to his death in the Gospel of John by looking at John chapter 9, the healing that continues to escalate his fight with the Pharisees over who he really is. Talking about that with Pastor Scott Kearns of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Kansas. Not to be confused with Lincoln, Nebraska, but a lovely place all the same, as he told us earlier. We're picking up at verse 8 of chapter 9, Jesus has just healed a man born blind. The guy is sent away to wash off some mud and spit from his face straight out of Jesus. Dust and water, interesting there. And he comes back seeing. Verse 8 says, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So they said to him, then how were your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. So what happens? You got a lot of confusion, right? No one's quite sure. He apparently looks a little bit different because he can see. He's like looking them in the eye. They're not used to that. So they think, well, maybe it's not him. Maybe it is. He's like, no, 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 guys, seriously. It's me. And, well, how on earth is it you? Jesus. And they're like, really? Where's that guy? Let's talk to that guy now. And he doesn't know. Now, this is just moving the story forward. But any thoughts about that, especially as we talked about kind of the parabolic nature of this, that there's a lesson here?
Yeah, well, before we even get there, I mean, I think it's interesting that they don't recognize him.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, why? Why did they not recognize him? And I think that there's a little bit there that the text maybe doesn't say, because when we think about what kind of radical thing that would be, you know, when we look at, you know, a guy who's been blind all his life, and, you know, what can he do? Can he hold down a job? Can he... You know, he's obviously not, because he's forced to beg here. So we know that. And so, you know, what kind of transformation would that be? You know, is he now able to see, you know, I can just imagine going from, you know, putting on, you know, these beggar's clothes every day to maybe, you know, wearing something different. You know, maybe he's, you know, well, I would say clean shaven, but that's not the case in this time. But I mean, certainly maybe a little bit more kept up in his appearance. And I mean, you could just imagine, you know, the question then actually makes sense. You know, are you the man? And I am the man is pretty profound. I like that statement when we think about, you know, our own humanity. I am the man. Isn't that a great quote? So,
yeah. And the idea that he's clearly different and yet he's the same. And in that sense, if we're going to use this, you know, allegorically a little bit here, but it would use this to see the picture of what Jesus does for us by raising our souls from the dead. You know, we who are dead in our trespasses and sins are made alive together with him through faith in who he is and what he has done. Then you have this edge where I am new, I am regenerate, I am a different person than I was, and yet I'm not. I'm still me. Nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. A little saint sinner going on there, and a little hopefulness about the real change, right? Of the day of resurrection, when our eyes, which are still blinded by the sin within us, will be so unleashed from the present age that we'll see entirely, even as a blind man who'd never seen now could see entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so we have you know, the idea of I am the man, but then followed, you know, closely with the man called Jesus.
Yeah, right.
You know, here is who Jesus is and what he does, because he anoints the eyes of the blind. He washes the, you know, sinners and gives salvation. Yeah, good stuff.
So the result of this then is the people are like, I don't know, it doesn't really say again. I mean, do they just kind of say, hey, come to the Pharisees with this? And he's like, okay. Or is it like they just grab him and they take him? But they bring him to the Pharisees, the man who was formerly blind, which is also doubly interesting in that it was the Sadducees who are the priesthood. And so if you're going to like deal with a spiritual condition that would allow you closer to the temple and all that kind of stuff, you don't go to the Pharisees, you go to the Sadducees. But they take him to the Pharisees. And verse 14 says, now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So here's that's kind of the big dropped hint. Oh, problem coming. So the Pharisees, verse 15, again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So the Sabbath issue, we should probably talk about a little bit. The Pharisees just start to grill him rather than being amazed, right? No one's happy about this. It's really bizarre. You would think they'd be happy for the poor guy, but instead they start to grill him. He gives them the same answer that he's been given. And you got this great, I washed and now I see kind of amazing grace picks up on that. I was blind and now I see. But then you got, you know, some are basically so hung up on the Sabbath that they're just going to use us already to condemn Jesus even more. But others are starting to question. I don't know. You know, this is pretty potent sign here.
Yeah, I could just imagine, you know, you could just kind of imagine the scene here, because, you know, it kind of gives us a time period here. So, you know, Jesus is going along, just got done with church, just got done at the temple. He's going along and he finds this man, and I'm going to heal him. And, you know, eventually we find out that, you know, they find out everyone, at least the Pharisees, know what happened. So it's not like some kind of secret or things. Here, Jesus is healing this man. They bring him in to be questioned. And like you said, nobody is happy about this thing. You know, they're saying, you know, how can this be? How can a man do such, you know, signs? You know, he must be a sinner. You know, so they ask him that, and it's interesting that the man purely confesses what happened to him. He says, I received my sight. You know, he put mud on my eyes. I washed. I see. No problem. You know, and you know this Jesus did it, and it's all good. And then they're like, oh, my goodness. And it's interesting that this division has arose among them. You know, it's they'll actually end up sorting out this division, because they'll just say, okay, in order to balance the status quo, we'll just all be against, you know, this man Jesus. That's how we'll figure out how to fix this. And so
you sort of get a little of the, if I can say it, social justice warrior mentality, where they just berate those who are questioning into submission. So guys like Nicodemus are eventually just silenced by getting yelled at. And so they just, they back off, and they get pushed into the crowd, and the crowd will swell against Jesus. And so that those who are concerned at this point, later, they're the very ones who come back and try to help him find a tomb after he's dead, and all this kind of stuff. So you certainly have that. The division is rectified by their hatred for Jesus, which overflows in so much malice that nothing can stop it. They continue to, and here it is. I mean, they're continuing to push it on this guy first himself. They want this man born blind to condemn him. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him since he opened your eyes?" And they're, in a sense, it's a weird question, because They don't want him to answer it. They don't want him to be honest about it. They want him to condemn Christ. But he says he is a prophet. And then they kind of freak out. Verse 18, the Jews did not believe that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight. So even though he's saying this, like, okay, it's a setup, right? It's all faked.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like, oh no, you know, these parents, you know, must have, I can't believe they let this guy kind of, you know, be living off of everybody for so long. And this is completely, you know, they actually have to, you know, call in the parents, because they don't believe at all. Not even a little bit. They want some kind of proof that what had happened was not a result of, you know, Jesus clearly healing the man.
And it's slightly understandable. I mean, today I hear claims enough from various corners of Christianity about miracles that are happening, and my first, you know, result is skepticism. But this is a guy who, again, his whole story, his whole history is it's sign after sign after sign, and they're building. They're getting more intense as he goes, right? This is more than turning water into wine. Now he's changing the very essence of a man's body, which he was born with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't believe it. So again, they call the parents, verse 19, and ask them, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" And it's again like they're accusing them. They want to berate them into saying, "Oh no, it's not true." But his parents answer, they have to tell the truth. "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." And then kind of the understory, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. And Chris, again, Chris is my favorite Twitter questioner. He always gives us good questions. He asks about verses 20 to 23. Parents fear being put out of the synagogue, so they avoided answering the Jews. Question, were the parents denying Jesus as the Christ? I think this is, you know, were they outside of the faith at this point? My own inclination is, well, they really don't know. They're just kind of unknown. And what's doubly important then is that the man born blind, he hasn't denied who Christ is, right? He didn't call him the Christ, but he was like, yeah, this guy did this thing. So thoughts about any of that?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I think that was a good question. You know, as we think about this, I'm not, you know, like you said, I don't think that either is you know, outright denying Christ. In fact, I think that the man, you know, is confessing what Jesus did, and the parents are, you know, just pointing it back to, you know, the man who's been born blind. And here I guess focus on something else. The whole idea of the threat that the Jews held over, you know, the people. I mean,
right.
I think this is certainly a huge threat that they would be able to put them out of the synagogue. I mean, that is where life itself is, you know. And you could just, I mean, that is what you did. I mean, I guess here in our day and age, if you got kicked out of your church, I mean, yes, it would be bad, but, you know, would it be life-changing? But here, this is something that would be life-changing, and that they kind of use this threat, you know, to basically have their way, or, you know, be kind of, this is the thing we're going to hold over you. This is the carrot that we're going to hold over you. Either you do this, or we're going to, you know, or the hammer is going to come down, if you will. So I think it was really interesting that they kind of go ahead and explain all of that, just in case we didn't understand or get that. So
yeah, I mean, with that, I've heard stories of Christians, particularly in the evangelical world, who begin discovering law and gospel, and they do this for a variety of resources, but a lot of online media resources, things like KFUO. There's other radio stations out there. There's other shows out there that are done by Lutherans. And they begin to discover this theology, and they discover that it's from the Bible. And so they start asking questions in their congregation. And if they're in some of these congregations, which are very leadership-centric, they're quickly told, stop asking these questions. And a number of them, and you can find these stories and hear, it's very painful for them because they lose their church. They are literally put out of their church, not as heretics. They're not excommunicated. They're just kind of shunned, yeah, and pushed aside as those who are, they're called divisive, is what the language is, that they are dividing the church, and that by questioning the kind of the divine leadership of the whoever happens to be the anointed pastor of that place. And so it's, you see this today as well. And what it gets back to, though, what are they trying to do with this shunning and this quieting? They're trying to quiet the words about Jesus. They're trying to quiet the work of the Holy Spirit, which is to create faith in Jesus because of who he is and what he's done. With about a minute left, any closing thoughts on that or anything else about the whole text?
Yeah, to just get the kind of the verse by verse kind of thing is to kind of, I think really, we got to see it in the full sense that we who are spiritually blind are now made to see, you know, as Jesus ultimately washes up us our sin and gives to us life and salvation. Word and sacrament here, absolutely what it's all about. So
my guest, Pastor Scott Kearns of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Kansas, talking about John chapter 9 here on His Times Daily Lectionary Study. Pastor Kearns, thank you for being with us. Give our best to the saints out there in Kansas.
Hey, thank you so much.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's just the beginning of the story. We got more coming tomorrow, right? This isn't over yet. But what happens? The light of the world, who has the water of life flowing from his own heart, leaves the temple because no one believes that he is who he is, that is, the I am who was before all. And what does he do? This water of life does flow from him. He takes his own spit and he heals a man who is unhealable, even in our modern day and age, a man born blind, unhealable. He heals him, and what's the result of those who don't believe in him? Hate. They hate who he is. They hate what he's done. What's the result for the rest of us, right? Are our eyes opened too? And the reason John writes this is so that the answer will be yes. You're like, wait, Pharisees, you're making a mistake. This guy's the Son of God. What's your problem? Can't you see it? That's the Spirit's work on you and in you. The faith being created by these things. You would even know then where Jesus' water comes to you in holy baptism, marking you as one redeemed by Christ the crucified. You would know where Jesus' body and blood unite with you in the Holy Supper. None of that has happened yet in the story. But you see those overtones, those shadows, right? You hear what's coming, and you know what's coming, that even this cross is not, it's not the end. It is the beginning of all things being made new. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, back in just a moment with Dr. Bob Weiss. Today's Worldview Watch. Stick around.